I'm Zoe Emily Forbes, and welcome back to the Spoken Woman podcast. We're glad to see you here. Enjoy the episode. So today I'd like to welcome my guest, Abigail Bergstrom, an entrepreneur, writer, editor and agent. Abigail founded Gleam Titles and was nominated the Literary Agent of the Year 2020 at the British Book Awards. She is also listed in the Bookseller 150, which names the industry's most influential. She has since left Gleam and is starting her own venture, founding Bergstrom Studio, a 360 publishing consultancy. And on top of all of this, her debut novel, What a Shame, is being released in 2022, which is now available to order on Amazon. And if there's any anywhere else as well, do mention it, Abigail. But welcome, and I'm really, really excited to have you here. Is there anything extra you wanted to tell us about, or any other ventures? amazing. So I suppose my first question was, so how did you get into the publishing industry, and how hard was it at the beginning?
It was really hard. It was really hard at the beginning, and I really struggled to get a job in publishing. I tried interning for a little while and, you know, did that usual thing, but it got to a point where, you know, sleeping on friends' sofas and not having any money just wasn't really sustainable. So I then took a job in digital advertising because I knew that the whole of publishing had become obsessed with digital and ebooks. So I thought maybe if I go in something like that, keep applying for jobs, it might give me an edge in an interview. But I interviewed for so many entry-level jobs and so many assistant-level jobs, and it was just, I would get to the final interview stage and just fail at the last hurdle. So I found it really difficult, but eventually I did get offered a job. I got offered a publicity assistant role.
Amazing. So I noticed you got quite far with them, and then you actually then moved to Gleam Titles to start. I found that. Am I correct in thinking that?
Yeah. So I was at Simon & Schuster for about 5 years. I was in the publicity department, I think, for only about 6 months. And then an editorial assistant role came up and I applied for that. And then I commissioned my first book within 6 months of moving over into the editorial team, which was kind of amazing. I think really lucky to be in at a publishing house like Simon & Schuster, where they let someone so junior commission and publish a book and kind of let me have the reins. And that was certainly an incredible experience that I was really grateful for. And I think it can be tough in publishing, and I do know a lot of editors who are sort of held back in that regard and kind of stuck doing the more administrative assisting things, and it can be really, really hard to force your way into the commissioning side of things. I commissioned there for about five years.
Amazing. Obviously, that's sort of where I found you, and that's where I sort of started following you from Gleam. And you were working with sort of a lot of online influencers and activists and writers and sort of pushing out their voices, which is quite exciting. I know in an article you wrote, I think last year, or worked with someone to write last year, talk about how it was like the democratization of publishing and how it allowed the people to really choose who they wanted to read rather than the media industry. Yeah.
That was an interview with Sondra and Tell, I think. And yeah, it actually kind of taps in a little bit to what I was saying before, in the sense that I think I was able to commission my first book early doors because of digital, because there were all of these amazing voices emerging online, and you could see people gathering towards them. And in that sense, I was able to approach these people and say, wow, what you're doing is incredible. One being Laura Bates with the Everyday Sexism Project. You know, I'm sure there's a book here, and would you be interested? And she'd already been, you know, thinking about the idea as well. So it was kind of a meeting of minds in a really nice way. But so I think the digital aspect I got to it because it was a way for me to discover authors. In the publishing industry, you rely quite heavily on agents, agents knowing who you are as an editor and agents submitting proposals to you. So when you're more junior and you're trying to kind of establish yourself, you don't yet have a list, nobody knows what your tastes are. So it's really hard to get to start getting those submissions and start getting that recognition that you need. So, but yeah, definitely. I think for me, digital talent, digital first talent, or writers that are just using the online space in new, creative, and inventive ways has always appealed. Yeah. And, you know, it wasn't that long ago that you needed a degree from Oxbridge or Cambridge to be deemed worthy enough to write a book. And I think what the internet did was create soapboxes for whoever the hell wanted to get on top of one and talk about whatever the hell it was that they thought or cared about. And the audience came, people flocked, and it sort of publishers, the dynamic sort of changed. A loss of control feels too strong, but I think the dynamic definitely changed in the sense that the audience was starting to dictate the possible opportunities for books.
Course,
and I just found
sense.
That sort of transition,
and
that
I suppose
rebalancing. Quite interesting.
One thing with all the successes that you've had in the past few years and with all the features you've written for all these different magazines and the awards and the nominations you've had, is one thing that a lot of people will be wondering is, what are your biggest sort of success and fail moments within this industry? Fail not necessarily meaning it feels like a big failure, but what you felt has kind of pushed you back or you've had to learn from it and push past it. What's Oh, it depends on what you want to do first.
Yeah,
which one's longer is the question.
Which should I answer first, the successes or the failures? I think it's harder to talk about failures, actually, because I think it's harder in a way to... I've always found it harder in a way to kind of sit and dwell on those because... you have to adapt. I think in many industries now, you need to be able to pull yourself back up, adapt, learn, adjust. And I think that's been my response to failure, good or bad, to learn from it and to take note of it, but not to sort of like dwell, or maybe even there's an element of denial where I've not really wanted to kind of look at it properly, which could potentially say a lot about me and my burnout, which I know you want to kind of talk about later. But I guess in a way I felt a sense of failure when I've walked away from different roles and gone into new ones. So working as an editor at Simon Schuster, I was building up a list, I was developing a list of authors. You know, I'd got to work under incredible editors, incredible people that had kind of taught me so much and helped me hone my skill. And I think moving on to do something different, and kind of move into agenting, which is a different thing. It wasn't that it was a failure, but I guess there was a sense of guilt in deciding to change tack and deciding to kind of navigate myself into a different part of the industry. I don't know if that's something that other people experience when they kind of do that. And I think, you know, for a long time, it's not that burnout felt like a failure. Mm. What felt like a failure was that I didn't see that I was burning out until I got to a point that I had made myself ill for the sake of pursuing something that I loved, but I lost that kind of balance, I suppose, and that was a failure for me. That was a failure to myself.
Yeah, we're back onto the burnout. I think
to not see that earlier.
One thing that I've noticed is everyone's opening up so much more about it now. Everyone's being a lot more vulnerable about it, talking about sort of what you can do to prevent it. But a lot of people don't associate it necessarily with successful people because they're so successful. You think they must be good at balancing as well. They must have a life outside of what they do. And I think what you mentioned in your article with Elle this month, called The In-Betweener, you mentioned so that idea of liminality where your whole the in-between, but your identity gets tied so strongly on one part of who you are that you kind of lose everything else. And I don't know, I wanted to ask you, like, is that kind of what happened before? Is that what happened before Christmas? Is it that became who you were, that you burnt yourself out so much for it and then you forgot there was so much more to you outside of your job?
Yeah, I actually think that's a really articulate way of putting it, actually. Definitely, my identity and sense of self was so tied up in my job and my work because I loved it so much and because it was so rewarding, because I was successful in it, because I was achieving things in it, you know, and that's kind of addictive in a way. And I adored what I was doing, which I think made it harder to see that I had lost that balance. And, you know, I definitely got to a point where I was just spending my weekend sort of on the sofa resting in order to recover to be able to do my working week. And I think so many of us feel that way, and so many of us have felt that way during the lockdown, where that connection to those different parts of ourselves and our different identities, be it we play tennis or we go to a book club or what have you, have been taken away from us. So I think you can absolutely be subject to burnout in a job that you love just as much as you can be in one that you hate. But I think for me, I lost grip of the other things other key identifiers or the things I identify with. I lost grip with the value.
No, of course. Because I know that you, you met your boyfriend just before lockdown. Am I right in thinking that?
Yeah, Mark and I met, I think in the November, and started going out seriously
similar,
in the January.
You with your career, obviously, last year, but I actually went, so I'm in a lovely relationship now with someone I love to pieces, but I was in a long-term relationship, thank you, I was in a long-term relationship with someone until sort of literally the beginning of lockdown last year, and we'd been together all of my 20s, all of university, and I didn't realise until we broke up, not for any bad reasons, it was because we realised our futures didn't fit together, because of what we wanted. I realized I tied pretty much my entire identity throughout my entire 20s to who, not he was, but who we were together. We realized that individually we'd both done that same thing. But when we broke up, that was me addressing my career. That was me addressing my friendships. That was like, I started thinking, do I want to be a florist? Do I want to go traveling next month? Do I just want to leave the country and just leave all my friends behind? Mm-hmm. Do I want to move somewhere else in London? I just didn't know what to do with myself. And, gradually over time you start to pick that back up again. But even now I still feel like I'm slightly, like, who am I? I think you're always kind of deciding your identity. And I think that's where, like you said in the article, it's very fluid. It's very fluid.
Course, it's very fluid, but I love hearing you say that, because I relate to that so much myself, in the sense of within the fertile void, which Dr. Julia Samuels describes as the place when we're kind of shedding our old self and not yet our new self, this fertile void, and within that there's so much opportunity for creativity to try on all these different hats, like you say. Like, do I want to be a florist? I certainly did that, you know, when I decided that it was time for me to leave Gleam. I certainly was like, okay, well, maybe I love my dog, maybe I should be a dog walker. Like, what do I want my life to look like? Where do I want to be? Maybe I should move. And it's so liberating, and it's so creative, and it's so interesting to think about all these different possibilities and all these different ways that you can live. And sometimes it takes a really drastic change or a move in gear to really bring those opportunities to the forefront and make you aware that actually, yes, you could be a florist for a living. I'm sure a very successful, incredible one, if you wanted to. And it really forces you to address, I think, grief. You know, again, Dr. Julia Samuel describes this kind of fertile void. It's a grief. As is a breakup, as you were just talking about. And I think within that loss, that's the room, isn't there, to see what else could be.
It is.
Which is exciting. It's hard. It's really hard and anxiety-inducing, side note. But this article is about kind of what can we take something.
I completely
positive?
Think yes. I completely think yes. And I loved what you sort of were writing.
Yes.
It was towards the end. You were talking about sort of, I think that your final sentence, which I've actually written it down, it was the worst human. The worst human affliction of all is kind of not knowing what's next. And you kind of got to take that, and you've got to take hold of that and say to yourself, like, I don't know what's next. But it's it's the idea of shedding your labels, which I find really strange, is in that fertile void, in that space of liminality, you're still seeking those labels. You're still seeking, like, what can I be next? And then you kind of attach yourself to a new label, which then makes me think, then do you not just jump back into the fertile void at some point, jump back into liminality? Or are you just always in that state of not knowing, you shouldn't really label yourself? Or I don't know. I'm not sure what you think on that.
Yeah. I think in the piece I would kind of refer to them as like key identifying pillars. And I think, labels is another good way of describing them, I suppose. And I think they're unavoidable, because what they do is they enable us to understand each other. You know, it's these certain things, single or married or in a relationship, or lodger, renter, homeowner, or, you know, they're so wrapped up in our society, and all the things good and bad with it, you know, kind of, class being one, for example, around whether or not you're a homeowner. It's like all of these labels that we assign tell us something or give us information. Yeah. So if somebody tells me that they're a nurse, I have all these stories in my head of all of the experiences that I've had with nurses throughout my life. And so you apply those to, you know, you start thinking about these. It's like, I think that's just how the human brain works. It's how we communicate with each other through categories, through patterns. I do think they are necessary to an extent. I mean, of course they are necessary. Otherwise, I think it would be impossible for us to communicate or understand one another. But I think it's more about not applying too much value or apportioning too much of yourself to one of them. I am a writer, and therefore... If my, like, the only value that I have is whether or not I'm successful as a writer. And if my debut novel doesn't do well, I'm a terrible writer. And therefore, I am terrible.
I'm getting scared for you as you say this right now. Like, don't do that, Abigail.
turmoil. When actually it's... Yeah. No, but it's that's not the case, right? Like I'm a loving daughter, and I'm a loyal girlfriend, and I'm a good dog mother, and I'm, you know, I make a mean fish pie. Like, there are all these other things about me that are valuable, and I need to distribute my value across all of those. Mm-hmm. And I think that's hard in a society that values output and productivity above all else, because then we are socialized to believe that certain things have more value than others. And it's, I think it's about us sitting down going, no, hang on a minute. What do I value? What is important to me? Mm-hmm. And the fact that I'm but the fact that for somebody it's being an incredible friend and showing up for their friends. If that's a thing, like, that should be celebrated and consciously valued. Mm-hmm. Whereas it's much easier for us to celebrate the fact that a friend got a promotion and a new job title than it is in the fact that they just show up for us every day in a meaningful way.
Yeah, where you put the value, and I just think that's what we have to start. No, it's really interesting. So while I was reading Atomic Habits, is it James Clear, I think, Atomic Habits? He was talking about sort of using those pillars, using those labels as sort of motivators and drivers to get to your success, as well as saying, for example, this is just a bit of a random one, but when you first started writing your book, saying, I am a writer, I am gonna be a writer. If it's good or bad, it doesn't make a difference. I'm still a writer, no matter what the success is. And allowing yourself the value in that pillar, no matter where you rank in society within that pillar, if that makes sense. So I'm a runner, I could say I'm a runner. I can run 3K barely. Mm-hmm. And I'm still saying to myself, I'm a runner, because at some point I would like to get to 10K. It's probably never going to happen in my lifetime, but I have to have the confidence in it. I have to say I'm a runner to get there. And I suppose that's the kind of the difference between the labels and the pillars. I don't really know where I'm going with this, but...
I see where you're going with it. I see exactly where you're going with it. It's you are a runner. You're running. It's the exact same for me. It's like, if my novel isn't a success, I'm still a writer. I still write. And I think we are brainwashed into, we can only attribute ourselves to those certain labels if we're producing a solid output or value, i.e. money. And the reality is, as somebody who's worked in publishing for, you know, a decade, I've seen the most phenomenal, incredible books do nothing. And I've seen very average ones sell a hell of a lot of copies and make a hell of a lot of money. And so it doesn't even make sense within the system. Again, which is why, you know, you as a runner, or me as a writer, we have to know inside ourselves and attribute value to that for us.
And then, yeah, and you start going into that whole announcement culture and the whole I want to be this. And yeah, it's interesting. Which is, social media does make it worse.
Yeah. But I think it does make it worse. It does make it worse. And I find that, you know, like anyone, I think, you know, I have a very complicated relationship with that. But I agree with what you were saying in terms of labels as manifestations and saying out loud. I wrote my book in secret for such a long time, and it took me. I mean, it wasn't even a book when I first started, but it took me such a long time to say to people, "I'm writing a book." And it's
It's funny, isn't it, when it comes to sort of announcing things like
motivators,
your
as well,
book,
can be really
when you find value in something so much so that you don't want to tell people, do you, until you know it's going to happen? Whereas a lot of people I do it all the time. I'll say I'm going to do something and then I never do it. I like the feeling of someone saying, "Ah, that would be really cool if you did that." And I'm like, yeah, I've basically done it now because I've told someone. But sometimes like hiding it and not like having it to yourself can actually, it provides so much
That's
more
amazing.
Value, and you then recognize that you're the only person that can add value to that. You're the only person that can find value in what you're doing. With your book, can I ask you when you started writing it? You can say no.
Yeah, of course you can. If I can remember, it was finished when I'd submitted it to agents during lockdown, and I probably had started writing it 2 years prior to that at least. So I just started writing on weekends for no other reason than to have a little space for creativity that was just mine, because I have a job where I make a living and I'm paid, as so many of us are, to give our ideas away and to use, you know, give our creativity to others. And that's something that I love. I love collaboration. I love working with other authors. I really get a kick out of that. I couldn't just be one of these people that sits in a room all day on their own writing. But I needed something that was just mine. And that's I knew I was going to dry up in my professional life if I didn't find a space for my own personal creativity. And so I would just sit and, you know, short story, or just sit and write whatever came that day and blah, blah, blah. And it sort of eventually I was, oh, okay, there's a thread here, or I've written about this theme a lot, and that's interesting. And it was from there I pieced it together and thought maybe this could
be a book.
It
takes a lot longer.
But I don't advise writing a book like that, because it took so much. So many drafts. But yeah, that was just my process. What a shame. It is about, what is it about? Shame at its heart, grief at its heart. It's about a young woman called Matilda, and she is in a state of grief. She's gone through a really difficult breakup. She's lost somebody very, very close to her. And it's about how we know how to deal with grief, right? We know how to deal with deaths. We know how to deal with breakups. We're told, we're shown in movies, in films, in theatre. There are rituals, you know? But eventually the rope runs out for these rituals and people move on. They have to move on with their lives, and the dramatic thing or the painful thing or the you know, loss that's happened to you, it just has to kind of adjust into life as people carry on. And I think there's a human experience of real kind of stuckness where you're still in this ebbing sadness, but everyone else has moved on. And I think that's such a kind of relatable space to be in. And so I think the book's about that. That's where Matilda is. And for various different reasons, her friends kind of guide her and push her into these sort of new age spiritual rituals and remedies and to try and kind of help her understand like what is wrong, like what there's a kind of darkness, there's something wrong with Matilda and she can't seem to quite get past it, and her friends are sort of pushing her into these various things to help her understand herself and what's going on. So it's like a
I'm excited to read it. It sounds really good. Did you find that it had, because obviously I was thinking maybe you'd written it during this time as well, because it feels like there's not crossovers, but there's those moments that of the need for mental space, those moments of grieving. And your book, from what you're saying and from what I read online when I was reading the blurb and reading all the reviews, it feels like it draws on some of that. So did you find like with what happened sort of through from January to sort of May, June, that there was weirdly some crossovers? Did you find comfort in rereading your book? Was there anything about your book that kind of related?
That's a really interesting
That's
question.
A no then.
Perhaps I've not thought about it before. So no, but I do think that Matilda is being forced to sit with herself. She's being forced to sit in her shame, and I think, you know, it's hard to ever talk about shame without referencing Brené Brown, the kind of prolific shame researcher, as I'm sure you're kind of well versed. But she talks about how shame can't handle being wrapped in words. It's like the one thing, it's using words to bring shame out into the light. And I guess for there's that kind of similarity or crossover, in the sense of being forced, we've all been forced to sit with ourselves in the most intensive way. There was no escape, there was no distraction, there was no people to mirror back what we wanted. All we had was ourselves and whoever we were kind of in the four concrete walls that we were in with. And I think that's made for some uncomfortable realizations and the surfacing of some existential truths. I think it has, and in that sense, yeah, there is something there is a synchronicity, I guess, but certainly not consciously, because the book was written and done before.
On to your next venture, you have started Bergstrom Studio, because I was pretty certain it hadn't started yet, but that's exciting. So what's going on with that?
I'm launching
on
Monday.
What is the idea behind it? Yeah. What kind of books are you looking out for?
Yes. Bergstrom Studio is a publishing consultancy. It's a 360 publishing consultancy, and it specializes in helping emerging writers find their voice. And so it offers a range of editorial services to writers, aspiring, published, people that want to write books, want to get their books out there, or perhaps you have a really incredible restaurant or food business, and you know that you're capable of a cookbook, but you don't quite know anything about what's happening in the food market and publishing, or how to convert your brand into that. So it's kind of about sitting with people who have brands and IPs and helping them develop into print, format. And then the other aspect of it is it's a hybrid literary agency. So I'm going to be representing authors and writers as well. So it's exciting. Amazing. And we're also launching a grant called the Bergstrom Studio Grant, which is going to subsidize the rent of an aspiring underrepresented writer, so that they might have a room of their own to pursue their creativity and have the opportunity to write their book. So we're going to be fundraising for the first year, and then after the first year of business, donating some of the profits to the grant, and then at that point we'll be able to kind of share more information on how people can apply. But it's a kind of home and community for aspiring and up and coming writers to come together.
I think that's really interesting. I was about to say to you, where would they find out about this grant, but you mentioned that sort of at the end of the year you're doing that fundraising first for it.
Yeah, exactly. So there's information on the website about the grant, but in terms of the application process, that will commence once we've Amazing. Completed our fundraising.
I'll make sure to notify any listeners when it does go out.
All the details are exactly
no, amazing. It's and so I wanted to talk to you about sort of finding your voice, how you found your voice. I know this is a weird question, we've talked about so much already, but being an agent, a writer, a publisher, working across, like doing a 360 consultancy, I know that as we've spoken, sort of voice, again, we can't label it. We can't be like, this is my voice, this is my pillar, this is who I am. So this is a hard question to talk about after this conversation. But it's, yeah. Mm-hmm. Like, how do you find your voice?
It's interesting, in though. This, it's made the question more interesting.
In this industry where there are so many people trying, there are so many different creative minds that bring such different realms of possibility into the industry, what kind of, like, how did you find your voice?
It's such a hard question to answer now in light of our conversation. I definitely think because if I was to look at my voice as an editor on the page, my voice as a 20-something-year-old mm-hmm. on Twitter, my voice speaking at a conference in Korea, or where, all of those voices have been...
Yeah.
All of those voices are different, and at different stages in my career, they were really, really different, because I was a different person. I was a completely different young woman yeah. with different ideas about the world and different experience. You know, I hadn't had the experience that I have now, and I suppose... You know, there is that where sometimes I look back at things that I've said or written, and that voice, I recognise it as mine, but it's definitely not the voice that I identify with or feel I'm in today. But I do think there is a consistent thread in how I've accessed that voice.
Everyone and loves that word at the moment.
That's just, I'm not going to use the word authentic. I'm not. I refuse. Yep.
Great synonym.
But I think there's something yeah. in, like, the honesty yeah. that's in your gut, you know? And that gut honesty of just what you think and what you feel and what you care about. I just think I've always just been tried to be honest about what I think or where I'm at or how I'm feeling, you know, and disclosing that I had burnout yeah. on social media was a really, really difficult thing to do, but for me it was
yeah.
absolutely necessary and part of my journey to recovery to do that. But that doesn't mean that someone else who has burnout, the right thing for them is to go and be really public about it, you know? But for me, that was so important. And I think that's yeah. it's just an instinct that I just feel, I think we all do. We all have this instinct. We all have this connection to ourselves. And that's the only thing that I've ever held on to. And the other thing that I would say is just don't be afraid to shock. And I think that's getting harder and harder. I think when I was younger, it was easier to be messy and say silly things on Twitter, just in the sense of, like, God, everything I tweeted about was about feminism when I was, you know, it was feminism, you know, it was on and on and on I went. And I don't know. I think now there's a lot more.
Yeah, it's not just feminism anymore. There's so many different parts of it. And you learn, you change your ideas, and you can't, like, I just, with the whole Mary Wollstonecraft, Catherine McKinnon, I don't really know Catherine McKinnon, like, her response to, yeah, same, her response to, her response to Mary Wollstonecraft, it's like, Mary is famous, she still is today, people still look at her like, wow, like, what's she done, it's amazing. But then Catherine McKinnon was like, no, I don't want a piece of this poison pie, I want a different pie, I want something different. And feminists, like, you, in this day and age, everything, you're learning all the yeah. time that whatever yeah. you say today, you could have a completely different belief tomorrow, but you've got to say it, because in saying it is where you learn. So I suppose that's where,
yeah, and yeah, I think so. I think there's just a responsibility yeah. to keep educating yourself and keep learning from those who don't share your experiences, especially those of course, of less privilege and from marginalised communities. And I think that's the thing that that's the thing that isn't necessarily difficult, but it's a responsibility. Mm. It's a responsibility that you have if you want to talk about or discuss a subject online. You have a responsibility in that sense then, I think. But yeah, I think it's hard. I think it's hard. And I think, you know, for people that are trying to get a job in publishing or people that are trying to build a voice in any space in order to create awareness and you know, share their works because they want to get employed and break into any different industry, I think it must be really, really hard at the moment. Do you find it? I mean, how do you find it?
It's hard. It's really, really hard. So I work in marketing for a tech company.
And how do you cultivate it?
Which is very different to anything I'd ever sort of wanted to do in the past. I love it now. But it's one of those things. I'm doing this podcast on the side because I've got a different part of my voice that I want to use. I don't want to, like you with your writing, I don't want to lose that. I write poetry on the side just for myself. I'm trying my hardest to learn the guitar, and I'm just like, for me, I'm a runner. Those 3Ks, I've started hot yoga, like that's not my voice, but it's finding my voice through all these activities because I haven't found it yet. I haven't. And I'm trying to find it, but then I suppose at the same time I have found my voice because I use it every day, and this podcast for me is part of that journey, and that's why I actually want to have these conversations with people, because that's so important to me as well. I think that's really, really interesting what you've said, and I thank you for being so amazing. Vulnerable on this. I didn't want to go into too much detail, obviously, and I'm really, really glad you managed to open up a bit, and we got to talk about your book and your agency and the burnout you felt and everything good that came out from Gleam as well with all your nominations. So like I said again, just thank you for coming on. It's been really, really great. And yeah. No, of course.
You're so welcome. Thank you for asking me.
Do hit subscribe, and also please leave us a 5-star review wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you so much for listening. See you next month.